morning and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, here's our number, 941-3689. That's the number to call if you're on Oahu. And from the neighbor islands or anywhere else, if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. You've heard the expression, money talks. Well, apparently it's speaking loudly in Washington these days. Congress is relegated to the sidelines as corporate lobbyists do battle for policy-making clout. Billions of dollars change hands, elections are bought and paid for. In short, American democracy has turned into a dollarocracy. That's the contention of Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author and activist. He's again partner with political journalist John Nicold in their recently released book, Dollarocracy. We last spoke to them when The Death and Life of American Journalism was published in 2010, and it's a pleasure to have Bob McChesney back on Town Square. Hi there.
Great to be with you, Beth Ann.
Nice to have you here. You've got a tough message for us. In your book, you talk about what some might call the real golden rule, that he who has the gold makes the rules, and those who do, billionaires and corporations and their lobbyists, often hide behind democracy. Would that be accurate?
Indeed, it is. And in fact, it was only a week or two ago that former President Jimmy Carter, speaking to some Germans, said that America, the United States, no longer is a functional democracy. And the research bears this out, unfortunately. Two or three major studies were published in the last year by leading political scientists, and they discovered or determined, the better verb to use, that if you want to understand how decisions are made by the U.S. government on core policies, you discover that poor people, working-class people, middle-class people have no influence whatsoever in the outcome. The outcome is determined almost entirely by wealthy, powerful individuals who influence those who govern our society. The connection between popular rule, popular control, and the policies of our government is so weak as to be virtually non-existent.
Over a dozen studies show that the wealthy have little empathy for the needs of the rest of us. I'm thinking about some of the ones that came out of the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and others since the last couple of years. Isn't there, though, a terrible disconnect between a government influenced in the way you just described and the people it's supposed to govern?
Well, that's the crisis of our times, is that I think the American people desperately want a government that can address the great problems we have and that responds to their interests and encourages debate and popular participation. But the crises we have are growing worse. They're not being addressed by government, largely due to the fact that wealthy, powerful interests control the policies and control the politicians and have pretty much precluded popular involvement. That's why we wrote the book. And I think specifically, Beth Ann, that I think everyone understands that rich people and corporations have inordinate influence over the government and policy, and they stack the deck so they stay rich and they don't pay taxes for things they don't like public education, Social Security, Medicare, things they don't think they really need, and they don't want to pay for other people to have them. But I think what we try to talk about in the book is specifically the election process, because in an egalitarian or unequal society, elections are that one shining moment when Bill Gates and the heirs to the Walmart fortune and a hedge fund billionaire have the exact same amount of power as the person who cleans the toilets at Walmart on the graveyard shift. And it's that one moment that we truly are equal. One vote, one person, one vote. And what we see and what we argue in the book is under dollarocracy, they've converted our elections into dollar one vote, that money controls our elections in a way that makes a mockery of democracy. It's been going on for quite some time now, but it's really accelerated in the last 2 years, specifically since the U.S. Supreme Court had its famous Citizens United decision in January 2010, which in effect said corporations and rich people could spend unlimited amounts on political campaigns. And also what it did in effect, although it didn't call for this in the opinions for the case, in effect it's allowed for anonymous money to flood the campaigns. It's unaccountable, that no one can track down, and to be spent any way it wants.
There are cynics who will say that, well, in some ways, you know, it's always been like this, that if you just follow the money, you'll see where the nexus of power and money really is, and that they've always cohabitated. Is this really so, or is this just sort of the knee-jerk reaction? Was there really a time in recent memory that you can point to us as, if not a shining example, but at least a better one?
Well, I mean, we've got to understand that what we have now is so different from what was even 20 or 30 years ago in terms of just the sheer amount of money. The 2012 election had $10 billion spent on the campaign, more than twice what was spent just in 2008. And even allowing for inflation, what was spent on the campaign in 2012, and this is all the races combined in the entire country, was 10 times what was spent just two decades ago. So we're at a qualitative difference in the amount of money. And, it's definitely had a significant effect on the nature of our politics. And, you know, rich people have always had inordinate influence in politics in any country where you have rich people. They have more resources. They tend to have more influence. That's a given. But that doesn't mean they always win every fight. It doesn't mean they can rig the system. We've had tremendous battles, and we write about them in the book historically, going back at least 100 years, with popular campaigns to reduce the influence of wealthy people, rich people, to control elections, to take corporations out of elections. And one of the striking things most Americans now realize is that there have been, over the course of the last century, scores, even hundreds of victories to limit the amount of private money that could dominate elections and buy elections. Popular votes. In the state of Montana 100 years ago, for example, the people, their state was so corrupt, it was like a third world banana republic. The copper companies owned the whole state of Montana, that they were basically appointing all the politicians. They owned both parties. They owned the state. And a popular referendum actually made it illegal for corporations to make any political contributions. That was done outside of the election system. It was just a popular vote. They had a similar vote in Oregon at the same time. And these are the sort of this is a great part of our history. People have really fought hard to have fair elections, to get the money out of us. And it was only with the Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that popularly embraced Montana referendum was thrown out and made unconstitutional after being in effect for 100 years and being much loved by all Montanans.
Bob, why is it that we just don't hear enough about these victories, including the one that you just mentioned?
Well, part of the reason we don't hear much about it now is that journalism, as we know it, political journalism, has been in free fall collapse for the last 10 or 15 years. It's really disintegrating before our eyes. And we wrote about that in The Death and Life of American Journalism, the book that John and I wrote that came out 3 years ago.
I remember that.
And we talk about that more in this book. I mean, there just are far, far, far fewer reporters covering politics today for a living. In newsrooms with fact-checkers and copy editors and competing with other journalists and other newsrooms to get the story right. There's just so much less of that than there was 15 or 20 years ago. But a lot of stories just slip entirely through the cracks, stories that would have been picked up 20 years ago. We're in a situation now where most Americans, when they go into the voting booth to vote, they don't really know who's running for anything, what's on the ballot, because the journalism is so horrible. What they have to rely on, basically, is word of mouth from friends, and more often than not, the content of political advertising on television.
So, essentially, we've got a country in many ways at odds with itself. On one hand, you've got consumerism fed by corporations wielding all kinds of power to influence government. You've got journalists who aren't covering this beat at all. And on the other hand, we have this idea of democracy. How do we get back to that?
How do we get back to democracy or to democracy? Whether
Depending upon which way you want to look at it, exactly. I mean, is there, I mean, you've talked and sort of hinted at, well, you know, there's an equalizing place. It's called the voting booth if you actually get yourself there. But that assumes that you're going to be able to do some due diligence, find out some more, and you're not going to have much help from journalists. So a lot of us are going to be on our own to do that. How do we really take back democracy if that's even possible?
Well, I think it is possible, and I think we're seeing it take place in America today, and this is another great unreported story. In the last year, literally 500 communities, or in the last 3 years, I should say, literally 500 communities in America have passed resolutions calling for Congress or their state to approve of a constitutional amendment to ban corporate money in politics in elections, to get rid of it. Countless other communities have voted and approved referenda of the same effect, or to guarantee the right to vote. So state legislatures can't monkey with it, like we're seeing really in what can only be described obscene ways that we're seeing in Texas and North Carolina and all these former Confederate states just in the last couple of weeks passing laws to make it much more difficult for poor people, for African Americans to vote, because they're afraid if they can't suppress the vote, their candidates can't win elections. And, you know, I think what we're seeing in America today is a reaction to that. I think Americans understand we need a government that really addresses the problems we face, and a government that's under the thumb of the dollarcrats, of whoever has the most money wins perspective, isn't solving the problems. It's making the problems worse. So the optimism is fed by that, and fed by the fact that in this country today there have been, you know, every single time we've had elections, and we've had hundreds of them now in referenda around the country in the last few years on money and politics, the side saying to get corporations out of politics has won every single time. And this includes the most red states, the most blue states. It doesn't matter where. No one thinks it's right that billionaires and corporations could come in and spend tens of millions of dollars on elections and basically buy elections. That simply isn't... it's not democracy, and you get what we get, dollarocracy, completely corrupt governance under the thumbs of wealthy interests.
You're listening to Robert McChesney, Professor of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, also the co-author of the book we've been talking about, Dollarocracy. The phone lines are open. How do you feel about big money in politics? Most of you call in to say how upset you are at all of this. We just saw a last election where there were many third-party contributions and a lot of political monkeying about that you weren't happy with. But a lot of you also said you weren't sure what you could do about it. Bob McChesney has a few thoughts. He's here if you have a question for him, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Can we really get our democracy back? That's the question. 941-3689, if you're on Oahu, that's the number to call, or 877-941-3689. We have an expression around these parts, you know, no vote, no grumble. But it's nice to say it. It's another thing when you actually have something that you feel passionate about that leads you to understand what you're voting on, what the candidates really have to say, trying to get a straight story out of someone. This is not perhaps unique to Hawaii, I would suspect. Of course, it's not. But what is an average person to do knowing all of this and perhaps feeling quite powerless despite the fact that he or she may vote?
Well, that's a great question, and all these are a similar vein, and I think you're really tapping into the concerns everyone has. I mean, for one thing, we should understand that Americans vote, as a rule, far less than almost all other major democracies. In the last presidential election, 52% of Americans over the 18 actually went to the polls and voted. In most countries, most of the other leading democracies in the world, large democratic, the voter turnout rate is more in the range of 60 to 80 or 85%. We're really almost off the grid. And it's sometimes we can beat ourselves up and say, see, Americans don't care, Americans don't vote. But as we explain in the book, it's actually astonishing that many Americans do vote, because it's so often you go to the polls, there's really, not only do you not know much about the candidates because there's no journalism and it's very hard to find anything out, but so many races now are gerrymandered. The vast majority of races for the House of Representatives in the United States and for most state legislature seats are gerrymandered. What that means is that every 10 years they redraw the district boundaries for House of Representatives seats and for state legislature seats, and the parties basically rig the system so they divide it up, and the party that dominates gets to get most of the spoils. So most of the seats are no longer competitive. People are lucky if they live in a congressional district where there's actually a competitive race, where it's not built to almost guarantee the victory of an incumbent for whichever party. And, you know, so the vote becomes sort of a joke if you know no matter who you vote for, it doesn't matter. And then when you get to the statewide races, like Senate or governor, the amount of money that comes into play is so great as to really preclude a lot of choice, too. So we think it's an astonishing statement that 52% of Americans actually do come out to vote.
Well,
given you know what you get as a result, we think Americans are yearning to be in a position where they can have a great democracy.
Well, it's good to hear some optimism, at least saying, look, why aren't you looking at the glass that's half full instead of being upset about the half empty? And still, that's where most of the discussion goes. Certainly in Hawaii, where we've had voter turnout spiraling ever downward since statehood, it's a really tough problem and one that certainly we've tried to grapple with not terribly successfully. We've got some callers on the line who'd like to talk to you, Bob. Going now to Mark calling us from Maui. Aloha, Mark. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, aloha. My name is actually Professor Mark Reese. I've taught with Yale. Been a dean with the Jesuits. Before that, as a whistleblower with NBC TV. You guys are singing my song, and I'd like to make several quick points, starting with a legal one that's the most in our favor. I'm in the process of writing a letter to five senators and a congressperson on these very issues, and I came across a speech by Abraham Lincoln in 1854 where he absolutely proves the 10th Amendment. No questions asked. The 10th Amendment prohibits the federal government from bothering anybody in any state in any way whatsoever. And the federal government tries to get in on the Commerce Clause. Not everyone agrees to the Commerce Clause, and I'm one of them. The feds only have power in D.C., in stolen territories, and in federal forts, prisons, and lately in parks. That's it. So they're in violation of the 10th Amendment if they try to impose anything on anybody. Now, that's a whole different issue than states behaving in a bad way. But there's another thing in the UCC, I believe it's Section 218, any act of fraud carries a 10-year prison sentence, potential, and $10,000 fine by any official elected or appointed. So there's all kinds of ways to start protecting ourselves. On the other point about voter decline, I've seen it too. I vote in every election, and it goes down and down and down. Yet when I speak to people on the same topic out in the real world, there is enthusiasm for this, just like the professor that you're interviewing says there is. So there's a drop between people acting on what they think. And that goes back to what I call a terrible time toddler training, which proves to people they're worthless chunks of meat and electricity, which is false. So we've got several different issues here, but we're not helpless. And I just wanted to share that the federal government is so out of control, it's beyond contempt.
Mark, thank you so much for the call.
I want
to get Bob McChesney to respond to you.
All right.
So what happens with that drop? Because, I mean, he mentioned something that you mentioned too, Bob, that there's a great deal of enthusiasm for becoming more involved and understanding what your role is as a citizen. And yet when it comes time to do it, especially in Hawaii, we see these horrible voter turnouts.
Well, one of the problems, too, that we talk about in the book is that the two-party system has really been captured by the dollarcrats. Both parties have, which means that it's frustrating if you're a voter because there really isn't a lot of choice. Now, there doesn't mean there aren't differences between the two parties. There obviously are in certain areas. But when you look at things like national security, war and peace, economic policy at the very top, there isn't really a great deal of difference. Both parties were at the top, the leaders of the parties, for bailing out the big banks. Both parties are for spying on people. Both parties for all these wars, military spending. So it's not irrational for a person to say, well, gee, I don't really see what the big difference is. And when you look at the studies that show the powerful moneyed interests dominate both parties, it only confirms that maybe it doesn't matter who you vote for, and that certainly represses the amount of people who want to vote, even people who are very enthusiastic about public life. You know, what we suggest in the book, among other things, is that it's imperative in our democracy that we try to open it up, and getting money out of it is a mandatory first start. But, you know, when we have these debates for elected office, they should let everyone on the ballot in the debates. They do that in other countries, in France and Britain and Germany. Even candidates who aren't seen as legitimate candidates have a chance to win or are allowed to participate in the debates. And it enlivens the political culture. It makes it much richer. We have this obsession with, you know, really having no competition. And, we're a country that prides itself on loving competition, yet we only have two political parties. I mean, it's absurd. And we only have two choices. And what economists teach us about duopolies, when you only have two players in a market, is that the smart thing is basically to imitate each other. And that's what we have. We don't have the range of debate of other democracies, the choice of other democracies, and that makes people less interested in participating.
I mean, really what you're getting by imitating each other is just causing a great deal of consumer confusion.
Yeah, and you know, there is differences between two parties, and I think the main difference comes in who their voting bases are. You know, the Democratic Party's voting base tends to be on the political left, far more progressive on issue after issue than the leadership of the party. And the political base on the Republican Party traditionally is just upper middle class people in business, but also includes a lot of people who have social issues that they really care about, especially women's rights and gay rights. And so, you know, their core constituencies are somewhat different, and that affects how the parties operate. But it's, again, the closer you get to important issues like war and peace and economics, the differences between the two parties at the top aren't that great. And that's where we need to have debates. That's exactly where we need to have a range of opinions and people sort of taking opposing positions. That's what would draw people into public life.
Well, you've touched a few nerves that are drawing people into this conversation. And for those of you just joining us tonight, my guest is Robert McChesney. We're talking about the new book that he co-authored with John Nichols, Dollarocracy. And from the title, we know you can figure it out. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689. If you're calling us from Oahu, use that one. From the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Going to Sachi, calling us from Kona. Aloha, Sachi. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I have a question for the guest. My brother is a commercial airline pilot, and I've been kind of researching this a little bit. In order to be a commercial airline pilot, you have to have a test that qualifies you based on ethics, and you cannot be a commercial airline pilot unless you go through this test. It's a qualification. I'm wondering why we don't have the same kind of a test for public servants. It seems to me that we all our lives are in their hands, and there's as much danger of having our lives in their hands as a commercial airline pilot. Shouldn't they have some kind of qualification? I know that they're not going to be the ones to pass a law doing this, but isn't that something that should be looked at?
All right, Sachi, let's ask Bob.
Okay.
Bob, well, did you hear the question?
Illinois, where I teach okay. At the University of Illinois, we have so much illegal behavior by our governors, so many of them going to jail in the last 20 years, that they actually make all public employees in the state take ethics training every year and take a test. So basically, because we have so many crooked governors, everyone who works for the state government, no matter what job you have, you could be the janitor or whatever you are, you have to take an ethics test thanks to those crooks. You know, I would say ethics tests are fine, but realistically, if we had a functioning democracy with a functioning journalism, that would do the job of weeding out people who weren't acting ethically. Voters would have the ability to say, okay, this person isn't the type of person I want. They're not doing their job right. And elections would do the job of monitoring the system. That's how a functioning democracy works. And it's sort of a statement about just how debauched and functionless and deranged our democracy has gotten that we have to come up with stuff like that, because we can no longer count on the voting booth to reflect the will of the people and keep the system working honestly and with integrity.
Bob, isn't though that symptomatic of, you know, much larger social issues, the fact that we would have to have sort of a Band-Aid solution of saying, here's an ethics test, as opposed to having people who really do understand ethics because that's how they've been trained from the time they were small?
And also, this does get right to the issue of money in politics. There's so much money in politics. We document it in the book. I mean, I'll give you just one example where this whole ethics thing gets blown out of the water. In 1970, 2% of the members of Congress, when they left Congress, became lobbyists in Washington. They become college professors, or they go into private business and leave Washington. 2% in 1970. Today, Bethann, over half the members of Congress who retire stay in Washington, go to K Street, become corporate lobbyists. That's what they do. Half the members who retire. And when they leave Congress now, it's becoming recognized that Congress is not your last job in a career. It's your way station to your real job, which is making $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million a year as a lobbyist in Washington representing commercial interests, corporate interests. Our whole system's been turned on its head by money. And what does ethics mean then? What are ethics when your elected representative has got one eye on his next job, and he knows that when he's in public life, if he makes the companies that hire these lobbyists for $1 million a year happy, he's going to be set up for life? Does he really care about his own voters who elected him when he knows he's got a huge payday if he plays ball down the road? I think that's the huge ethical problem. The way you solve that ethical problem is you've got to just take the money out of politics, because as long as you've got that sort of money payoff, it's going to be impossible for all the ethics tests on earth to change the system.
And several states have tried to do that, including our own. In the case of Hawaii, perhaps we're still in the experimental stage of all of that, moving forward, inching forward. We have other callers on the line, Bob, who would like to talk to you. Going now to Dura, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Aloha. That's an amazing statistic, the 50%. This blows me away. I think that and this is a question too, but the local politics and the local mayor race here on Oahu, I felt like we were sold a rail candidate or a not rail candidate, and it was whoever propped up the most money. And I was thinking on a smaller local scale, how prevalent do you think the corruption is with money and the overall buying your next candidate?
Bob, I think the question is going to, how does this trickle down into local politics? If you've got so much money at the top and key issues in local races, then the money's going to go there too.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we chronicle in the book exactly the flood of money in city council races and local races where commercial interests realize there's a lot at stake. There was one city council race in San Diego, California last year that basically had millions of dollars spent on both sides, most of the money coming from out of state, much of it from these that are commercial interests that have a stake in the outcome. And so you've got a ton of money going into these races, and there's very little journalism covering the races. And these ads that they pay for can have a tremendous amount of influence. And I think the research shows that money has more influence the farther down ticket you go, because there's a greater likelihood there will be no coverage whatsoever, no journalism. And in the book, we talk about one set of races in particular where the corruption is the only word I can think of is obscene. 39 of the 50 states in the United States allow their Supreme Court judges to be elected by direct vote from the public. Now, this was a great victory for the American people 100 years ago. We won this in the progressive era because the judges were so corrupt. We thought if we had elections, we could get all the corruption out of the judiciary. Well, about 25 years ago, the system worked pretty well. Usually the ABA, the American Bar Association, would recommend people, and people would get elected, and they were sort of, it was a respected position. And our judicial system had a great deal of integrity through much of the 20th century as a result. About 20 years ago, the dollarcrats, led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers, realized that if you could take control of these state Supreme Courts, they could overturn basically all the cases beneath them in the state level. And that's all those civil suits, all the lawsuits, anything that affects regulation of corporations at the state level. And in the last 20 years, they devoted a fortune to basically buying state Supreme Courts around the country. And they've been very successful. And it's been a tremendous victory for the dollarcrats, because it means basically a lot of state Supreme Courts are in the pocket of big business.
And it also means that perhaps they get to spend a whole lot less money to be able to do it.
Well, I'll give you one story we have in the book, which is really incredible. In West Virginia, the mining company that had the big blow up a couple of years ago in West Virginia, and 40 people died. Well, about 10 years ago, it had a ruling against it for, I don't know what it was. It was like $10 or $20 million. And the CEO of the company appealed it. And while the case was in appeal, he spent a and getting one of his friends elected to the Supreme Court to give the Supreme Court a 3-2 edge for his side. And when the case came to the Supreme Court, it was thrown out by a 3-2 vote. So he basically bought a member of the Supreme Court who threw out the case that would have cost his company $20 million. So we chronicle it in the book. This is the level of corruption we're talking about.
This is all incredibly scary, and yet somehow you remain ever hopeful. Let's see what one of our callers has to say. Going now to Maui's in the house again. Bud is calling us from Maui. Aloha.
Hey, aloha. How are you doing?
Doing pretty well, thanks. What do you make of all of this?
Well, let's see. I worked with the policy director of Gore 2000. I made a film about the American election process. I'm a motion picture director. The opposition to me releasing a documentary on the election of 2004 and 2000 and then later 2006, I mean, we were getting sued. We were getting sued by fake liberal groups that were opposed to people seeing information exposing wrongdoing in the election process. I got shot at while working on the movie. I had people from the municipal authorities condemn the bill I was in. And trying to prevent me from releasing the movie. Now there's interference on the line. Can you hear that?
But yeah, Bud, we've got a lot of interference on the line. So if you want to make a quick point, do that, because we're going to have to move on. We're having a really difficult time hearing you.
Okay. Well, that's sort of the story of our life. Anybody that works to try to protect free elections in America deal with a lot of corruption. And I was offered a $2 million bribe not to release my movie. I didn't take it. Oh, there goes the interference again.
Okay. Thanks very much, Bob. Bud, I'm sorry. Bob, I want you just to comment a little bit about that, because trying to find out information that you should have access to under FOIA or through other means seems to be a real stumbling block, even locally here, trying to have a place where journalists can go and feel like they can get information that they're supposed to have invariably comes up short.
Well, that's right. And this gets to one of the major themes of the book, which is the role of the media, the decline of the media, the corruption of the media. Because, you know, for the private citizen, for you or me or any private citizen, just to go do a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request, and monitor the material and go through it would be very difficult, time-consuming, maybe even impossible, unless you've got some specialized training. This is the work of journalists. And as we lose journalists, we no longer have people doing that and doing the hard work of sifting through files and making sense of them. Because if you do a FOIA, they don't just hand you on a gold platter exactly what you're looking for. It requires a skilled person to go through the papers and documents and make sense of them and know what's going on. And the decline of media is a huge part of the crisis of our elections. The reason why we have a press system in the United States going back to the beginning of the Republic, one of the core reasons was that Jefferson, Madison, Washington, all the framers understood that the election system, the whole constitutional system, wouldn't work unless there were a press system that drew people into public life. That's why the framers instituted massive public subsidies, postal and printing subsidies, so we'd have a huge range of newspapers, which we did in the first century of American history. And it was instrumental in making this a much more democratic country. Our press system is an abject failure today, and that's one of the reasons why our electoral system is an abject failure. You know, Jimmy Carter, I keep referring to, has the Carter Center now in Atlanta, and they go around, and they're the leading group to monitor elections to make sure they're free around the world. And they've done it now, I think, in the last 20 years in 92 different countries. And so if there's ever going to be a controversial election in a Venezuela or some country, the Carter Center is the ones that go there to make sure there's no monkey business going on. Well, Jimmy Carter and his Carter Center said they wouldn't even accept monitoring the U.S. elections. The system is so rigged and so corrupt. We don't even pass the same bar that Haiti and, you know, Lesotho meet. We can't even get qualified for them to monitor us because they don't think it's on the level here.
So,
that
Bob, if they won't do it.
It's about the situation we're in.
Yeah, it does. But if they won't do it, who will?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think that what that means is that we've got to understand what we're up against. But again, I think that what we talk about in the book, and we think the history of America has always been a struggle over the vote. It's always been a struggle over who's going to control the country. You know, the beginning of this country, the vast majority of Americans could not vote and did not vote. I mean, it wasn't like we had everyone running around in 1796 from party to party talking about politics and then going to the polls together. African Americans women couldn't vote. In most states, white men couldn't vote unless they owned significant amounts
property,
of property.
Right.
I think in one of the great elections in American history, James Monroe and James Madison ran against each other in Virginia, and something like 4% of the state's population voted. That was considered a typical turnout, and it was mostly just wealthy white people who voted, obviously, white men. And so we've had a struggle throughout our history to expand the franchise. to get women to vote, to get African Americans to vote, to get young people to vote from 18 to 21. These were enormous, great victories. We've always been in this constant struggle between the many and the few to expand and enrich our democracy, and it ebbs and flows. There have been great periods in American history, going back to the Jacksonian era, to Reconstruction and the following Civil War, to the Progressive era, 1900 to 1915, the 1960s and 70s, in which the sort of the non-moneyed forces won great victories in the society. Much of the stuff we most treasure about America today, the 40-hour work week, not having child labor, Social Security, Medicare, these were victories that were won by people organizing, and we can win those victories again. But if you remember, there's one crucial point, Beth Ann, about all those moments of reform, starting with the Reconstruction. They're all typified by one thing. They had three or four major constitutional amendments passed in each of them. Reconstruction, the Progressive Era, the New Deal, and in the 1960s and 70s. All those constitutional amendments were thought to be impossible to pass until right before they were passed. And what John Nichols and I argue in our book is that this is such a serious crisis, it's going to require a number of constitutional amendments. The right to vote has to be put in the Constitution so state governments can't monkey around anymore denying black people the right to vote. This is outrageous, denying poor people the right to vote. Outrageous. We've got to put it in the Constitution like almost every other democracy in the world has. We've got to take corporate money out. We've got to have it in the Constitution. Now, it's difficult to pass constitutional amendments. It's not an easy thing to do, but it can be done. And you get it done by organizing around the issues. And I think that's where a lot of the energy is going right now in the country, beneath the radar of the news media. We're seeing all over the country efforts to get support for passing constitutional amendments to sort of put democracy in the Constitution once and for all.
What do you say about how the pendulum has swung, and we see this happened, you know, throughout history, that there's been crises that have been so much in the consciousness of the nation that we've had to have several different constitutional amendments, and those seem to be the points at which we look back and say, ah, the golden days of democracy, there we are, and that we are ripe for another one again because of all the crises that we are experiencing now. That seems to be the hopeful part of the book, that in fact, you know, we can see something good come out of it, but it's not going to take, but it's not going to come without a great deal of work to be able to do that.
It's going to take a great deal of work, but I think that, you know, we saw glimmers of this, and I live in Wisconsin part of the time, and I was here in 2011 when there was the unexpected massive uprising of, at one point, up to 150,000 people occupying the Capitol and surrounding it, peaceful, lovely, wonderful demonstrations. And it was followed by all those Occupy demonstrations, and it caught everyone by surprise. No one anticipated this was going to happen. They thought most Americans were asleep at the wheel. They had no concern about what was going on in the country. And I think one thing I've learned from my years of studying politics is that you can't predict the future. And so what we know is the situation we have in the United States right now is untenable. It can't go on forever. When you have this sort of corruption, it means your infrastructure collapses, your economy stagnates, there's no future for young people, our schools are disintegrating. There's problems that just get worse and worse, and eventually they have to be addressed one way or another. They can't be untended forever. And there will be a reckoning of some sort. We have to hope it's a peaceful, humane, intelligent, democratic solution we get. But there could be a worse solution. Those are always, history doesn't make you any promises. But we have to understand that history, the future cannot be predicted. I'll give one brief story about this that I think says it better than anything I can possibly say otherwise. I had a graduate in graduate school in the University of Washington in Seattle. I had a professor who was a white South African, and he had left South Africa because he was opposed to apartheid in the 1960s and moved to the United States, became a U.S. citizen. But all his family remained in South Africa, and he followed South African politics very closely. And this is, again, during the era of apartheid. And in 1988, as I was leaving Seattle to move to Madison, he pulled me aside and he said that his family was getting rid of all their property in South Africa. They had lived there for centuries. And they were going to move out of South Africa to the United States or to Europe. he said they decided it was hopeless, that apartheid would never be overthrown in South Africa without major violence. It would just be a hellhole to live in. It was, the situation was absolutely hopeless. They finally were giving up. Well, 2 years later, Nelson Mandela was free. 5 years later, he was the president of South Africa. And I think no one died in the process. Maybe one or two people did in car crashes or something. So they were completely wrong. You couldn't. They had no idea. They knew the situation was untenable, but they didn't think there was any hope for change. And there was radical change, wonderful change, nonviolent change. And I think we have to be open to that, too. When crises grow severe, the people of this country are concerned. I mean, the people of this country are not happy with how it's going. And this cuts across the political spectrum. And, I mean, this is where there's real common ground among people, regardless of what their political values are. I mean, I think it tends to be more people on the left and more progressives and more liberals who are more concerned as a rule, but not exclusively. And it can't always be predicted by political values of that nature. But I think what's clear is that people do care, and they're just looking for a way to constructively solve the problem.
But your
when
point,
they sense they can have it, I think they will act.
But your point, Bob, that, for example, history makes no promises, in the one hand that you just talked about with the South African example, that could be a foil for what happened in Germany, people believing that somehow it would get better, somehow there would be a way around it, and yet we saw what happened there. So your point of it is you can't take anything and say that it's going to be prescriptive. It's just that right now the circumstances are ripe for something to happen. Which way it'll go really is going to be determined by how we decide to handle it.
Well, I would add one other thing to the mix, because you're absolutely right. What I would add to the mix is that from my perspective, I'm 60 years old now, so I've been around a while. This country, the United States, is probably more progressive, more democratic, small-d democratic, and humane than it has been in my lifetime. And I think this is one of the reasons we have this great crisis of dollarocracy, is because I think if we had fair elections with real choices and 60, 70, 80% voter turnout, we would have a very different type of government. We would have a completely different type of politics than we have in this country today. And I think the people, the dollarcrats, those atop the system, know that. And that's why in the last 10 years we've seen this major shift towards having unlimited money in elections, toward making it okay for state governments to suppress the vote in ways that both parties thought were obscene as recently as 2007. I mean, they were considered outrageous. Now It's standard. It's because the dollarcrats know they can't win a fair election. They've got to game the system, flood it with money, and, you know, make it easy to suppress the votes of the people they can't buy off. I think that is the situation. You know, so we're in a situation where it could be dangerous, but I think that right now we've got the numbers on our side. I think that the winds of history right now are with the American people solving this problem in a democratic manner.
Well, it's good to hear some optimism. We've got callers on the line who would like to talk to you, Bob. For any of you just joining us, my guest tonight is Robert McChesney. We're talking about the book he co-authored with John Nichols, Dollarocracy. If you have a question, call us now, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're calling from the neighbor islands. Going to William calling us from Manoa. Aloha, William. Thank you for your patience.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could point me to some studies that would show how money is buying the elections, because the ones I've seen have basically said that when a candidate doubles their money, they really only get about 1% more of the vote.
That's a great question. And actually, I'd recommend you look at our book because we talk about that at length. And there's supreme evidence that money does buy elections, that everything else being equal, whoever spends the most money will win. And the more you spend, the effect it has. And let me explain why this is. But the second point you made actually supports that claim, that a lot of money might only buy 1% of the vote. Because
but 1% is enough.
Election, I'm sorry?
But 1% it sometimes can be enough.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, in elections, the whole thing is to get 50.001 in a two-party, in a two-person race. And if you spend a fortune, even if 95% of the population couldn't care less about your ads or what you're doing, if you just shift enough votes to win the election, it makes perfect sense. That's why these people spend so much money on these political ads. And the other part of these political ads, and we haven't talked about them in the show yet, they're a central part of the book because they're such a huge part of our political culture now, that they're overwhelmingly negative. And this has grown sharply. Last election, roughly 90% of all the television political ads were attack ads on other candidates. They weren't ads in favor of a candidate. They were just against and attacking another candidate. 50% a decade ago, and it was like 25% a decade before that. It's where all the money's going, are these visceral attack ads. And these ads, everyone hates them. I don't know anyone who says, yeah, I really love these attack ads. People, want to vomit when they have to watch a play to these. But the research shows, as much as people hate them, when they do focus group surveys of people, and they'll feel, yeah, I hate these ads, I won't pay attention to them, I won't vote for candidates who do them, and all this sort of stuff. And they talk to the exact same people after the election, ask them they vote for, they find out that when they explain their vote, they oftentimes just recite what the negative ads said to explain why they didn't vote for the other candidate. That these ads actually do work, especially when there's nothing, no journalism of any value to counteract it.
Thanks very much for the call, William, and thanks very much for the answer, Bob. It's kind of tough to take to have so many of us have, fingers point at us that, you guys aren't doing your job. There aren't enough of you. It's such a hard place to be stuck in when you know that you'd like to do that, but there isn't the wherewithal to make it happen. You've been really critical over time, and we've talked about this before, of what kind of job we collectively are doing. Do you see any hope there on the horizon now?
Well, I think in the book I talk about this, and in my other research I've gone into this in greater detail. Journalism's a public good. The market won't provide it in sufficient quantity or quality, at least a popular journalism that'll really do the job a democracy needs. And for about 100 or 125 years, we had the illusion that journalism could be commercially supported because advertising provided the overwhelming majority of the revenues for newspapers or broadcast news or news magazines. Well, advertising is in the process of completely abandoning journalism because as it goes online, the whole advertising industry is in the process of changing. You no longer buy media and place your ads on a website for the New York Times or for a TV station or anyone else. You just buy the audience. It's called smart advertising. So General Motors doesn't select 30 websites to run ads on. Instead, it says we want to reach 10 million women, 25 to 34, who might buy cars. And they'll find those 10 million women, whatever website they're at. Because as we know from the NSA scandal, these companies basically know everywhere you go online, who you are, how to find you. Wherever you go, they will find you and run the ad. And as a result, there's no money anymore for journalism. So journalism is no longer commercially viable. That's why commercial interests are jumping ship. Now, the first 100 years of American history, before we had much advertising, the way we solved that problem was we had massive postal and printing subsidies to spawn this very rich print culture. Policies that were pushed through aggressively by Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, and Washington. They all understood this was imperative. And we dropped those when the commercial system started to work. Well, now that the commercial system is failing, we've got to go back to basics. It's understand it's a public policy issue of the highest magnitude and come up with a way to get resources so we can have competing, independent, uncensored newsrooms covering our communities and that are accountable to our communities.
We
talk about ways to do that in my other books. This isn't a central theme of this book.
No, I know that, but I was just asking you because that last book came out, about 3 years ago, and I remember we having had that conversation. And there have been some subtle shifts in the last 3 years. I'm thinking about ProPublica, and I'm thinking about locally here, Civil Beat, other partnerships with universities and journalistic endeavors, newsrooms, that have made a shift, however subtle it may be, but still a shift from what we were looking at, 3-4 years ago.
Well, there have been, and these are instances of philanthropists or wealthy individuals bankrolling to the best of their ability, newsrooms doing nonprofit, non-commercial news. Some of it's fantastic, and some of it's great. But I think even the people who are doing these things would be the first to admit there's not enough of that money to support what a free society needs. Not even close. It's simply not going to be sufficient. I mean, ProPublica's total staff is probably 1/10 of what one mid-sized daily newspaper had 25 years ago. That's their total staff covering the country, the world. And that's the one thing we talk about. Well, what we've lost is so much larger. I mean, and that, again, it's not criticism of ProPublica, but it's criticism of the idea that we can hope that some millionaires can pay for our journalism for us. There's just not enough millionaires who are going to put their money into that to solve our problem. And I don't know if it really is such a great idea to let millionaires sponsor journalism like the Medici sponsored art. You know, I think it's too important for a free society to let it be the plaything of the rich.
So it might be setting us up for sort of a journalocracy.
Well, I think it's just not a solution. And I don't think anyone, there's no way you can look at it and say, that'll solve the problem. We don't have to worry anymore. It's going to require public money. And look, if you look at the rankings of the most democratic nations of the world, but made by, for example, The Economist magazine, the conservative business publication out of Britain, The Economist ranks all the countries in the world on how democratic they are, using traditional criteria, how much freedom there is, how much honesty there is in the government, you know, the various criteria, you sort of voter turnout. And the countries that rank at the top of the Economist list every year, and we document it in the book, are invariably the countries that spend the very most in public media, not the top, necessarily, but Hawaii Public Radio does, but they spend a fortune per capita on public and community radio and television, that support competing newspapers and communities, that make it a high public priority to have working journalists covering their communities, and don't think that you can just trust advertisers to support it, because then they clearly won't.
But we got so used to having cheap journalism, cheap food, cheap a lot of things, that the notion that somehow we really have to pay for quality seems to be so foreign to us that we don't understand that a lot of the world has been doing that for a very, very long time. We've got more callers on the line, Bob. I want to get to some of them. John calling us from Makiki. Aloha, John. Well, thanks for your patience.
Thank you. I read just the other day that the head of the Star Bulletin is now also the head of the Chamber of Commerce, which is pretty interesting considering the early conversation about the Chamber of Commerce is around the country. I just appreciate any comments about that. That seemed to me right off the bat a conflict of interest.
No, I missed the first half of it. Who's now the head of the Chamber of Commerce?
The head of the Star Bulletin, the main newspaper in Hawaii, or at least on Oahu.
I see.
That seems pretty strange to me.
Yeah, I agree. That is strange, because the Chamber of Commerce, it has sort of an innocuous name, and it maybe 100 years ago it was more of an innocuous organization. But in the last 40 years, as we document this in the book, it's a key part of our argument about dollarocracy. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and its various local affiliates has, instead of being just sort of supporting some local drugstore to help them get a, you know, tax break, instead has become the main vehicle for organizing corporations and the most wealthy individuals to change the politics of this country. It's an aggressively partisan organization. And so if you've got a main newspaper where the head of that organization also runs a newspaper, I think that leads to very serious concerns about, you know, that newspaper's credibility on issues pertaining to the economy and to politics in the state.
Just in general, the whole notion that somehow we would further entangle commerce and government in some sort of way is something that you think that we should obviously be guarding against. The question is, when you have a place that may be small, like Hawaii, where you do have a lot of sort of incestuous relationships, how do we do that?
Well, you know, you institute all sorts of rules and laws to prevent these things from happening, which we've had in many states. I suspect Hawaii has a fairly progressive tradition. It wouldn't surprise me if there have been some excellent laws on the books there to minimize corruption over the years. I certainly know that Wisconsin, where I spend a lot of my time, has in the past had some of the strongest anti-corruption laws. And you can do that. I mean, we can win these fights. We've won many of them in American history. We've got a tough time of it now because the dollarcrats, the Chambers of Commerce, the Koch brothers, these large companies, the energy companies, the banks, you know, they're much better organized today than they've ever been in the past. That's a lot of what the story of the book is how since the 1970s, business has basically said, we've got to take this government over and make it work for us. And they've worked aggressively. You know, for example, most companies, trade associations, including the Chamber of Commerce, have had their headquarters in New York prior to the 1970s. In the 1970s, virtually all of them en masse moved their headquarters to Washington, D.C. The increase in corporate lobbyists went up tenfold, 10-time increase from the 70s to the mid-80s. Basically, the corporate community, you know, so they're, we're taking over this town, and they have. They have taken it over. So,
and then you layer on top of that, you know, Citizens United, and I know we're running out of time a little bit, but I want to ask you something about what happened a few months ago when we had a Harvard sociologist and political scientist, Theda Scotchpole, here, and she floored a lot of people when she pointedly said that we shouldn't look for Citizens United to be overturned anytime soon. It was really going to be a bottom-up situation, which in many ways is what you advocate. Do you think she's right? Is there just not enough will to get something like Citizens United overturned despite everyone's upset over it?
Well, I mean, it's not a matter of will. I agree with Professor Scotchpole now, but I assume what she means is that the current Supreme Court majority will never overturn Citizens United. And I think that's absolutely correct. It would take several new appointments to get to a point where we could overturn it. And that's one thing to work on, but I think it's much more important to do the grassroots work to put pressure on to create popular demands.
Well, that was her point. Her point was
Right. And I think the history of the Supreme Court shows that that will do a better job of bending the Supreme Court than winning all the legal arguments in the world, you know, in a debating society. You know, there's a reason why we had Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which prohibited segregated schools, when only 56 years before that, Plessy versus Ferguson, with almost an identical case, said segregated schools were perfectly okay. And the reason was the facts hadn't changed. What changed was the country had changed, and there had been the beginning of integration, and there had been the beginning of a civil rights movement, and a recognition that America could no longer have apartheid. And I think that's the sort of, you know, the pressure from below is what woke up the court, that it could no longer condone segregation. It could no longer condone apartheid. And I think, you know, that's the sort of pressure we have to work on from below. And it might manifest itself in a constitutional amendment, a series of them, but it might be enough to get the court to wise up and just come to its senses and realize that the claims it made and Citizens United were simply preposterous on their face.
Meanwhile, we have an election coming up in very short order, and we're going to see a lot of the outgrowth of Citizens United in ways that will make what we saw in 2012 pale. That was another one of her points, and she said that we really need to get ready and assume that we're going to have to do a lot more due diligence. Is that really possible? And I'm going to give you about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye.
Well, she's absolutely right. She's a smart person to make those comments. And I'm about the due diligence. Look, we have our work to do. But you got to know what you're up against. You got to know the nature of the problem before you can solve it. And that's what we wrote the book. But we do think it's solvable, and we know Americans want to solve it. We don't meet any Americans unless they're Karl Rove or the Koch brothers or Shelley Adelson, who think it's great that people are spending this sort of money buying politicians and buying elections. There's no support for that with the great mass of Americans.
Thank you so much for spending the last hour with me. Wish we had more time.
My great pleasure, Beth Ann. Thank you very much for having me.
I'll look forward to next time. Thanks very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Robert McChesney is professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is an author and activist. His latest book, co-written with frequent writer, partner, is political journalist John Nichols. Their recently released book, Dollarocracy, has been the subject of tonight's Town Square. And we will talk to you next week about something else that you just might be interested in. We hope you'll plan to be right here with us. I will see you next week. Meanwhile, Lynn Waters will be with you tomorrow morning with Chris Vandercook on The Conversation. Have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.